Next talk is by Zoom. Tam Minot will tell us about collective movements on many scales. Please.
So, do you people hear me? Do I speak loud enough?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. So, good morning. I'm really disappointed not to be here today. I managed to stay away from this virus for 2 entire years just to get it before the symposium. So, bad luck. But in any case, I'd like to thank Thomas and Jean-François for this invitation and making sure that I can deliver the talk today, even though it has to be via Zoom. Okay, so I think there's no need to introduce collective movements to this audience. And what you're currently seeing are sheep flocks captured from a drone in Scotland. And it's remarkable, I feel, that very discrete environmental perturbation. And here, just a hole in the fence and a few shepherd dogs can lead to rapid movement of sheep collectives from one field to another. And this is really because local perturbations are sensed by a few individuals, and information is then rapidly propagated to the rest of the population. And I'll try to show that conceptually similar mechanisms also operate in collective groups of predatory bacteria. And so really the bacteria I'm gonna discuss today here, this is a snapshot, this is Myxococcus xanthus, and you see those movements on agar are pretty similar to the movements that you've seen in the sheets. So our model system is Myxococcus xanthus. It's a sole bacteria that predates collectively on other bacteria. And so this movie captures the entire Myxococcus life cycle. So before I actually start, let me just tell you what you're looking at. You're looking at the petri dish where a Myxococcus colony has been plated next to an E. coli colony, which is here used as a prey. And so as I start the movie, you can see the first phase is, you know, expansion of the Myxococcus colony, you know, in the direction of the prey due to motility on surfaces. And that expansion will ultimately result in encounter with the prey colony, which leads to the first transition, okay, where this is called the so-called invasion phase, when Myxococcus actively kills and grows on its prey. Okay? And this is followed by a new transition where you can see the formation of those characteristic waves, and those waves, which have been called the rippling waves, and I'll discuss them in more details in this presentation, propagate over the entire prey colony and precede the final step of the developmental stage with the aggregation that you see on the left side of the screen, where the cells actually now move in those centers and form so-called floating body structures inside of which the bacteria sporulate and then are ready to start the new cycle once a new prey is encountered. So really the power of this model is it's an experimental system where each transition can be studied in space and time on a single petri dish. So today, I'd like to discuss how those multicellular transitions can be explained across scales, starting from a single cell level understanding, and then trying to connect this knowledge to higher orders, such as seen in the multicellular assemblies that you've just seen on the movie. So, if we start in a very reductionist context, and just asking how does one single Myxococcus motile cell change direction, you can see this is in the movie, and you can see what we call a typical reversal event. You see that the cell started moving right, and then it moved left, and as it changes direction, you saw a polar inversion such that the pole that was initially the leading pole became the lagging pole, allowing the cell to resume movement in the other direction. We and other groups have studied the molecular details of that polarity switch in details, and I have, for the sake of this talk, to tell you about the main players of this molecular mechanism. So I really strip unnecessary complexity to show that polarity relies really essentially on the interplay of three main determinants. You see the blue protein here, which I'd be referring to as the MGLA protein, it's the spatial activator of motility at the cell pole. And it can only act, and motility can only be activated if that protein resides at the cell pole. But this protein cannot on its own localize to the cell pole. It requires the green protein, which I'll refer to as the RAMR protein, as a polar localization factor. At the back end of the cell, the blue protein is repelled by the red protein, the MGLB protein. And so these three proteins set a stable polarity axis that can be switched and, you know, triggers a reversal event. Experimentally speaking, you can see those dynamics, you know, if you label these proteins with, for example, green fluorescent protein, and you see, for example, MGLA switching from one pole to the other, leading when the cell is changing direction, and you can see the reverse type of behavior for the B protein when it basically switches from back to back when the cells are actually reversed. a bit more molecular details. Now, these proteins are molecular switches, the type of which you have all heard about. In fact, the MGLA protein is a bacterial RAS-like GTPase that becomes active when it's bound to GTP. And in fact, its guanine nucleotide exchange factor turns out to be the ROM-R protein, which localizing at the front loads MGLA in the GTP active state, allowing it to activate the motility complex. And I'm not going to get into any details of the motility complex today. At the back end of the cell, the B protein is, in fact, the converse activity. It's a GTPase activating protein. So what it does at the back of the cell is basically activates GTP hydrolysis in the MGLA protein, converting it in the inactive GDP-bound state. So basically, you see all of these proteins at the molecular level, you know, basically can regulate the nucleotide, the bound state of the MGLA protein. But what you need to know is that the transition, meaning the reversal, the switch, is not something that occurs spontaneously. It actually needs the input of energy. And this is provided by a signal transduction system called the FRZ system, or which I'll be referring to as the FRZ system. Okay. So this system consists of a receptor, here shown in blue, which, when it responds to signals, activates downstream kinase, which then transfers the phosphoryl groups to two so-called response regulators, the FRZ-X and the FRZ protein, which will then act in tandem to provoke a reversal. And I will describe precisely later the key properties of these regulators and the properties that they confer to the system. But at this stage, it's just important to know that this regulation is central to the formation of coherent multicellular factor. This is just a simple experiment where a wild-type strain is plated next door to a FRZ minus strain. And you can see that the FRZ mutant, the one that cannot actually provoke reversals, the cells are still motile, is unable to form most multicellular behaviors, for example, rippling and the formation of proper aggregates, ultimately leading to protein bodies. Okay, so really, I think I've basically set, you know, the basis for the topic of today's discussion, which is, can we use our understanding of that circuit I've just, you know, started to describe to explain collective behaviors at single cell resolution? But first, what we need to determine is what type of signals triggers reversal. And we've been searching for that signal for a long time until we ran an experiment, the type of which is shown on the screen. It's a very simple time lapse where you can see moving cells, you know, moving on minimal media. So there's virtually no chemical signals here. And this is shot at very high temporal resolution. So the temporal resolution allows us to segment this movie using a deep learning procedure that we recently developed in the lab. So we can get every single cell and we can track every single cell across this entire time lapse. Of course, the time lapse is shortened and you don't get the entire time lapse. So we can actually obtain, you know, single cell and individual trajectories. Those trajectories are shown partially with the colored lines, but you also can get those dark circles that you see on the screen, all the points where the cells are actually reversing. So an experiment like this, you know, is shown here, where you basically get, you know, the collective and you get the single cell, you know, measurements through the collective. And what you can do first is that you can project the cell densities to see which areas of the surface have been mostly visited. And you see, you know, this projection, which is shown as a heat map. So of course, the redder, the more densities. You see that the cells are actually constrained within zones and that spaces remain empty. And you can therefore see high accumulation of cell densities at particular locations. If you now do the same type of projection where you now map the reversals across the entire sequence, you discover that they map to the higher density areas. Okay? And now here you need to remember that the cells move as a two-dimensional layer across the entire movie, which suggests that the densities are formed by colliding cell groups and that reversals occur when cells collide. And so the conclusion maybe would be that the areas where the cells are reversing are formed by collisions of cell groups. So how could we prove this, or how could we measure this in better details? So here we define the local polar environment for any given cell. Okay? And for you to understand the method, three examples are shown to illustrate the approach. On the left panel, you see a cell that's moving within a group of otherwise aligned cells moving in the same direction. And so the polar environment we define for that cell is maximal, and it's a value of +1. Okay. In the middle example, you see a cell that collides, this time perpendicular to a cell group, and so the polar environment for that cell will be close to 0. Okay. And the other extreme, of course, will be when a cell is moving in a flow of cell that's moving in the opposite direction, And in that case, the polarity for that cell will be minimal, it'll be minus one. So you see that you can determine basically the immediate environment of cells by determining the local polarity, and the local polarity will be between minus one to plus one. Every positive value will be cells moving in similar directions, and negative values will be reflecting cells moving antagonistically. So now if you do a series of experiments where you're going to just run movies and look at global polarity and refer those polarity to reversals, this is what you get. So first, I'm showing you three independent experiments for about 5,000 events of reversals that were measured. And I can tell you basically, distribution for the mean time between reversals, meaning the time that separates two reversal events for these experiments. But if we now basically sort these events in categories based on the local polarity, meaning that we're now looking at how cells reverse when they are either in a low polarity context or either in a high polarity context, then you see that the cells that are in the low polarity context tend to reverse much faster than the cells that are in the low polarity context. And so we conclude for the experiments that the cells tend to reverse upon collision with other cells. And so our hypothesis is now that mechanical cell collisions are the main signals that will induce a reversal event. So now that we know this, and that we know the signaling network, can we use this knowledge to understand, a multicellular pattern, and for example, this rippling pattern I've actually mentioned in the discussion, okay? In the introduction, sorry. And so when you look at rippling, and this is actually shot by binocular loops, and the scale is about, this is millimeter scales, you see that rippling forms over the entire surface that's occupied by the prairie, but only on the surface that was formed by the prairie, which is shown by the dotted white circle, and it forms those antagonistic waves that appear to move in bidirectionally and collide with one another. If you look more closely in time at how rippling forms, and this is also a simple experiment where Mixococcus cells are labeled with red fluorescence, and the prey here is not labeled, but I'm showing you again this dotted circle to tell you what the prey initially is, we can look at rippling formation in time. And you see that during the invasion phase, 24 hours after plating, no rippling is formed as the cells are actually invading the prey. At 32 hours, you see that densities are forming at the edges of the colony, but the cells have not started to undergo rippling. But at 48 hours, now you see stripes form on the colony edges where those densities were initially formed. And if you zoom in, now you see the stripes are really the characteristic stripes that you get for a rippling pattern. And at 62 hours, now this rippling behavior has spread to the entire prey colony, and now you get the characteristic rippling pattern that I've shown you with the binocular. So now that we know this, what we can do is we can zoom in those areas where rippling form, and then shoot movies of rippling extensively so you can get the movie like this, okay? So before I start the movie, I'm just telling you what you're looking at. Again, you're looking at the border of a prey colony and outside of the prey colony, and so you get two areas, one that's non-rippling and one that's rippling, and the movie is shot for a period of 16 hours for about 2,000 time points, and this is, of course, greatly accelerated, but this is the type of images that you're getting. And so we've done a lot of measurements in this kind of movies on, trying to measure local cell alignments and the distribution of reversals. And I really don't have time to get you into the experimental data. I'm just getting you into the conclusion that in those rippling areas, cell alignment is occurring over persistent distances. Okay, so this, the cells are exceptionally well aligned in those rippling areas. And as we've seen in the previous experiment, the cells tend to reverse upon collisions. Okay, note that these observations had already been made by a series of authors, and their names is listed on the slide, with a significant difference because they were posing that specific pole-to-pole collisions that occur during rippling mediated by specific receptors could be important for signal exchange leading to the rippling pattern. And here the distinction is that we think and that we model that simple mechanical collisions are going to be sufficient to mediate reversal without any need for specific genetic determinants or specific physiology. So how can we get into this? And to get into this, I need to get you into a bit more complexity on the properties of the signaling network that I've shown you in the introduction. The first property, okay, is that the free system activation is in fact biphasic. It can only lead to two possible states, okay? There's an off state, okay, at low cell densities when the cells don't collide with many cells. And there's an active state where the cells actually are in a high cell density and collide many times. And you can switch very rapidly from one state to another. And this is really linked to a property of the Frisex response regulator, of which I don't have time to get into more details. But in this cartoon, what I need to introduce is the dynamic cycle of the polarity protein, so you can really understand the properties of the system, emphasizing the function of two regulators, the RAMR protein and the Frisex protein. So remember, as I mentioned, that RAMR is required for the polar localization of MGMA. However, what I did not say is that as soon as the cell reverses, it relocalizes to the lagging cell pole, which you show here, for example, as the location of the blue protein, okay, due to an interaction with MGLA. MGLA cannot follow that dynamic because it is systematically repelled by MGLA. So RAMR builds the net cycle because it builds at the back of the cell. And this relocalization is, in fact, a slow rate limiting process that provides a refractory period into the system. In other words, the system cannot reverse again until RAMR is fully relocalized to the back. Okay, but once RAMR is localized to the back, it's still not sufficient for the cell to reverse because the action of MGLB is still active. And this is where Frisex phosphates comes into play, because its action will be localized to the back of the cell, likely inactivate MGLB and allow the system to actually switch. So two proteins are regulating the cycle, and that confers two properties. First, you can simulate the off state, and this is basically a series of simulation based on a series of partial differential equations that show that how these proteins, you know, basically change localization, you know, during the reversal cycle. And you see that these proteins change localization very fast upon collisions, and then they adopt a stable state, okay? And you see from the blue curve that the relocalization of the dark protein is slow until it reaches the maximum at the back end of the cell. And that is when the cell is ready to basically sense another collision and then reverse. So basically, in the off state, the cells are ready to reverse upon collisions, and any collisions will trigger a reversal. This is no longer true for the on state, okay? Because in the on state, the cells will be basically colliding very much with other cells. And so now the concentration that this Frisex phosphate is no longer limiting. And so what becomes limiting is the RAMR refractory period. Remember that you cannot activate new reversal until RAMR is actually, you know, at the back of the cell. So basically now, the cells will reverse every time the refractory period is expired. And so the cells enter an oscillatory state. You can see it from the blue curve. Now, basically, as soon as RAMR reaches the maximum at the back end of the cell will reverse and will oscillate back and forth. So if I lost you here, just remember those two conclusions. In low cell density regions, the cells will reverse as soon as they collide with other cells. In high density regions, the cell will reverse as soon as the refractory period expires. The second property is a bit more complicated, but I need also to explain it, is that the refractory period is in fact regulated, and it's actually set by this other regulator I mentioned, the Frisex protein. And the phosphorylation of Frisex basically shortens the refractory period, you know, in a concentration-dependent manner. So when you enter the on state, you turn on phosphorylation of Frisex, and Frisex reduces the length of the refractory period so that the cells are oscillating, of course, but the period of oscillation can be variable depending on the local environment, okay? And that you can capture experimentally. For example, if I show you the green cell here on top of the screen, this is a cell that's locked into one oscillation mode, but the purple cell is one cell that was initially in the off state, entered oscillation with a fixed, you know, oscillation period, escaped that oscillation period, turned back in the off state, and entered a new oscillation period, which is distinct from the initial, you know, oscillation period. And that's actually linked to the level of this Frisex oscillation. So hopefully I kept you on track. And now basically, just to tell you that now we're ready to write a model where basically we're going to write that the cells can be either in the off state and either in the on state, and writing again a series of partial differential equations. And really, I'm not going to get into these equations, but I'm just going to summarize the key properties of the off and on models. Okay, as I mentioned, in the off state, which occurs in low density regions, the reversal rate is set to be variable, activated by collisions, and the refractory period is set to be constant. However, when the cells transition to high density areas where they encounter a number of other cells and get a number of collisions, then they enter the on state, which this time is marked by a constant reversal rate. Remember, the Frisex protein is basically non-limiting, so basically it's constant. However, it has a variable refractory period because now basically the Frisex regulator is now tuning that refractory period, okay? And this is basically the main differences between the on and the off state. Okay, so we can now basically, you know, use this model to actually simulate the behavior of the cell, which you saw here. They're shown, you know, each cell is shown by a line. And you can see that, you know, for a simulation of 600 cells for a time frame of about 200 minutes, that after alignment is obtained, and you start getting patterns, and those patterns are resembling the pattern that I've shown you, you know, in the ripping field. But of course, you can be more precise, right? What you can do, for example, is get out of this kind of experiment of simulations, you can extract the chymograph representation of cell movements, for example, projected along the dotted line axis, and you can get individual cell trajectories from this, and you can see those typical zigzag motions of cells that will be moving and reversing whenever they meet other cells. And what you can do over the cell population is you can measure the distribution of the time interval between reversals. And what's remarkable is if you get clearly two distinct populations. You get one population that is cells that are actually in the on state, and those cells are actually cells moving back and forth at the collision sites, okay? And you can get those cells that move between collisions, okay? And those cells are in the off state, okay? So basically the prediction of the models, if we actually go back to predicted experimental measures we should get, is that we should get two populations, you know, cells that are in the on state and cells that are in the off state, and that should be the hallmark of a ripping field. So is that true? Well, we can actually run the experiment, okay? So this is basically the same, you know, over a field of cells. We're actually measuring, you know, basically cell trajectories along a dotted line axis to extract a chymograph. And you see, can see that sure enough, the experimental chymograph is resembled the simulated chymograph. And you can actually get those two cell populations when you measure the distribution of the time interval between the reversals. You can get the characteristic two peaks. You can get the off cells, the ones that are actually moving in between the reversals, and the one that keep hesitating, I should say, oscillating at the collision site, that reflect the on state. Okay, so really, I think there's a beautiful match between the experimental measurements and the theory. You can run this experiment, you know, at much higher depth. For example, in a field like this, where what we shot is, you know, a field of rippling cells next to a field of non-rippling cells, where we had mixed color cells labeled in green and in red fluorescence, and track those cells, of course, across the entire Earth, to actually look at the distribution of the time interval between the reversals. If you now look at the rippling field, which is framed here in blue, you see that you get those, you know, two populations, and this biphasic you know, distribution is clear in the rippling field. If you do the same measurement outside of the rippling field, now you see that you do not get the second peak, and that you get something that is more matched by an exponential distribution. So really, this is again confirming that there is indeed a, you know, a separation between two populations that is supporting the formation of the ripping field. You can then use the simulation to test the importance of the regulation of that refractory period by removing the Fris-Z regulator into the model. And so what you see on the left side of the screen is a simulation run with the wild-type cell with the formation over time of characteristic, you know, wave patterns that form across the densities. And you see that you get a distribution of the time between the reversals that's biphasic with the on and the off cells as predicted by the model. If you actually remove the regulation of the refractory period by removing the Z protein, what you get now is that you're not forming this pattern anymore, and you are not getting the second population, the population that corresponds to the Fris-Z. Okay, so really that shows that the regulation of the refractory period is essential to synchronize cells in the high collision regions so that they move together in the off mode. Okay, and really that brings me to the conclusion of the presentation, where I just wanted to say basically the take-home lessons are that motility regulation as a function of local collisions is sufficient, you know, at least in our experiments, to generate the ripping patterns. And in this mechanism, the cells are synchronized in the high density regions via the regulation and of the refractory period so that they move coordinately outside of this high density regions into the off state until they reach a new high density region and synchronize them. So I'd say that in principle, this, going back to my introduction slide, this is similar to cognitive mechanisms. It's with local perturbations, again, are sensed by individuals and then propagated to the larger community by short-range interactions. So just to conclude, where are we going now? Well, our next step is to simulate, you know, both ripping and non-ripping collectives based on the idea that there is no distinction between those collectives that's based on local physiology or changes in gene regulation. What we believe is the main differences are the local environment that are being faced by the cells in these two contexts, highly aligned within the prey area, not so aligned outside of the prey area. And so you can actually measure those alignments. For example, this is, you know, an emetic analysis that we've run to actually measure the alignments. I'm not going to get into the details of that analysis, but just suffice it to say that if you get the same color, you know, over persistent distances, the cells are highly aligned. If the colors keep changing, like in a rainbow, then that means that the alignments are locally broken very rapidly. And you see that outside of the rippling field, you get low local cell alignment, but in the rippling field, you get high local cell alignment. And we believe that this is really the main difference, you know, for those two areas. So now, basically, we're basically trying to simulate this experiment that I've shown you already in the rippling field. You can see that the simulation, which is shown on the right part of the screen, is actually quite nicely matching, you know, the behavior of the rippling field. We're not here capturing the behavior on the non-rippling area. And this is because I think we need to add a component, which is the extracellular matrix. And this extracellular matrix, which we believe is self-deposited by the cell, is what is the factor that constrains these cells within local regions and avoids that these cells can actually explore the entire available space. And so next time, hopefully, I'll be in person and I will show you the results of that simulation. And with this, really, I'm coming to closure. I hope that you could hear and understand this talk, although it was at a distance. You know, of course, I really need to thank the people that were involved in this work. There's a large list of people that were involved. I just want to insist on two people here that were very precious for this talk. All of the experimental work and simulation has been taken care of by Jean-Baptiste Saunier, a graduate student in the group. And this is a thesis that co-supervised with Vincent Calvé, a mathematician at the École normale supérieure de Lyon, with whom we've basically, basically helped us and write the models and the simulations. And with that, I'll be thanking you for your attention, and hopefully I'll be able to take some questions from my screen.
Thanks.